Hello, everyone. This is George Hayes. Usually at this time, Orson Welles is heard with his own individual commentary. However, Mr. Welles is indisposed and will not be heard. So today we present a special summary of the week's top news developments up to the moment. 1 year ago this week, the war in Europe came to an end. Happy cries of victory ricocheted from the coasts of America to the frozen wastes of Siberia. For now the world could begin its trek back to normalcy. Now we were on the road to reconversion. But during this very same week of celebration on the anniversary of VE Day, this country has seen an industrial atomic bomb thrown into the reconversion machinery. Black gold. Cool. The stuff that is the key to our automotive and transportation systems held the eerie spotlight. Ever since April 1st, America's entire economical setup has been grinding to a standstill. Now, 6 weeks later, wartime measures like rationing of fuel and brownouts have cropped up throughout the nation. All this because 400,000 soft coal miners went on strike, a walkout called by Union chieftain John L. Lewis. Among other things demanded by Lewis is $3 million in back holiday pay. But this week, events took place with startling swiftness. John L. Lewis called his miners together and told them to go back to work Monday, tomorrow, but that did not mean the end of the strike. For Lewis had called for a truce, a 12-day period for negotiations with the operators. This was agreed to by the operators, and much speculation has been making the rounds of the nation's capital and in the coal pits themselves as to just why Lewis made this unheralded move. Why did the strong-willed head of the United Mine Workers throw in the towel temporarily? Some observers claim that the truce offer was made because of growing public pressure against the strike. Others insist that Lewis was trying to forestall any government legislative action which might hurt collective bargaining as a whole. But whatever the reason, the nation this afternoon waits patiently, or perhaps impatiently, for the harmony that President Truman says must be reached before Wednesday. This week, federal officials showed a surprising amount of optimism. They lifted major transportation restrictions imposed by the government to conserve fast-dwindling coal supplies. At midnight tonight, the general embargo on freight shipments will be lifted, the railway express embargo will be lifted, and limitations on the size of parcel post packages for mailing will be eliminated. What's more, the government also canceled the further 25% reduction in railway passenger facilities, a reduction scheduled to go into effect May 15th. However, other agencies like city management and governments have looked upon the truce with varied reactions. Chicago immediately lifted its brownout regulations, and this move was quickly followed by other local communities throughout the nation. However, other huge metropolises like New York City took the attitude that they're from Missouri. They want to see that coal before any emergency measures are rescinded. Stirred by events accumulated and magnified by the coal crisis, Congress is getting ready to swing into action. The Senate is prepared to start debate tomorrow on labor legislation. Legislation which may put an end to strikes, legally, or at least, curb them. These walkouts, like that of the miners, vitally affect the public welfare, and some senators are of the opinion that this is all wrong. Meanwhile, strict controls went on the output of coal during the two-week truce. The output in all cases will be doled out by Uncle Sam. First preference will go to utilities, railroads, laundries, hospitals, and so forth. After all these needs are filled, then the precious coal will be earmarked for the nation's factories. And this afternoon, the United States government and its people are looking forward to complete harmony in the coal crisis, looking forward to smiling men in coal pits with pick and shovels very busy. Strangely, discord seemed to reach round the world this week, even to the Paris peace conferences, where the word failure is bandied around as much as a ping-pong ball. The whole thing seemed to be getting no one anywhere, and rumors had it all along that the conference would break up with exactly nothing accomplished. One major thing was apparent. In the year of peace which followed the war, no peace treaty was written. Like the coal strike, as long as there is merely a truce with no peace treaty set down on paper, the situation remains more or less up in the air. And during the past week, it was more, definitely not less. What faced the foreign ministers of the Big Four was what to do with Italy and all that belonged to her. How to share the loot, as it were. To the victor belong the spoils, was agreed. But to which victor goes how much, spoils, seems to be the $64 question. Secretary of State Burns' ideas ran smack into those of Foreign Commissar Molotov, and the result was hardly one of sweetness and light. Burns said that the matter ought to be left to a general peace conference to be held on June 15th in Paris. Then, says Burns, perhaps the 21 allied nations could do what the big four nations could not do. Molotov couldn't see things that way, claiming that the big four first ought to draft preliminary plans. With this snag hog-tying the conference, the Russian diplomat pulled a surprise. He agreed to compromise. And compromise is one thing that the Russians up to then had never done. So on Friday, things took on a brighter hue, with some observers going as far as to predict that the entire treaty-making situation would be accelerated. And just as the American viewpoints were clashing with those of the Russians in Paris, so were they in New York. On Wednesday, when the delegates of the various nations at the United Nations Security Council meeting filed into their chamber, one member was conspicuous by his absence. For the second time in 6 weeks, the Soviet diplomat, Andrei Gromyko, refused to show up. Gromyko stated flatly that the Soviet Union simply would not take part in any discussions which touched on the Iranian situation. Any discussion about Iran automatically meant that Gromyko would prefer to walk around the block. It's even been hinted that Russia's political feelings have been hurt. In every major issue raised this week, an Anglo-American bloc has opposed Russia. These issues, as you know, are the Russo-Iran dilemma, the Great Britain-Greece situation, the continued presence of Anglo-French troops in Lebanon and Syria, the proposal to allow the Albanian government into the UN, a proposal sponsored only by the Soviet Union, and Poland's request for immediate action against Spain. Now, in all of these questions, the American and British delegates took opposite stands from the Russian representative. But it was the Australian delegate who posed the most important question of the week. How could the United Nations work effectively as a unified body when one of its major members attends only when it wants to attend, to hear issues only when it wants to hear them? And that seems to be the chief dilemma still confronting the UN. Palestine presented the world with another burning problem, literally burning, for riots were frequent in the Holy Land. Tension mounted daily during the week through the Middle East as a result. It all hinged on the Anglo-American Committee's report recommending that 100,000 of Europe's Jews be admitted at once to Palestine. In this recommendation, reaction among the Arabs was violent. King Ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia, the most powerful ruler of the Muslim world, said ominously, "We believe this recommendation is a betrayal." And later he said, "I can no longer ask my people to be quiet." Incidents and rioting and killings were reported all through the week from Palestine. Disquiet and unrest seemed the order of the day, and it's increasingly more evident that it is necessary to throw oil at once on the troubled waters which are overrunning the Holy Land today. Over in the Far East, United Press reports said that during the week it was decided that Emperor Hirohito would not be asked to appear as a witness or to testify at the war crimes trials in Tokyo. One officer explained that the results obtained from such action would not justify the trouble that might be caused by the Japanese people. The whole policy at the moment in Japan, judging from events of the past week, is leave the emperor alone. Meanwhile, General MacArthur received a visit from his boss, the Army's Chief of Staff, General Dwight D. Eisenhower. The biggest parade ever staged by American soldiers was held for General Ike. And Uncle Sam's number one GI saluted the men of the 1st Cavalry Division as they strode by the Imperial Palace. And this past week has seen the departure forever from Italy of its one-time ruler, Vittorio Emanuele. The former Italian king and his wife stepped aboard an Italian cruiser and sailed into exile. They begin their new life today in the guest palace of the Egyptian king, Farouk. A cordon of police lined the entire route after the former Italian monarch arrived in Alexandria. The late development in the Iran situation has cropped up, and now it seems that the negotiations of the past week between the Iranian government and the self-proclaimed autonomous province of Azerbaijan have broken down. What's more, the Tabriz radio claims that Azerbaijan is ready to fight if it fails to win its demands on Tehran. The announcement blames what it calls reactionary elements in Tehran for the failure of negotiations. And a new wrinkle in public relations was introduced in this respect. The Iran propaganda minister, Prince Firouz, refused to let newsmen visit the Azerbaijan premier, This despite the fact that the Premier expressed a desire to see the newsmen. The Premier, you know, headed a delegation which went to Tehran 2 weeks ago for the negotiations. The delegation has been living in a walled estate from which newsmen have been barred. Earlier, a guard at the estate said the negotiations were all over. Right here at home, President Truman celebrated his birthday, his 62nd, this past week. And Mr. Truman also took to the air lanes during a four-hour visit to New York. The chief executive, speaking from Fordham University, placed a great importance on the shoulders of the nation's educators in the future of the American people and mankind. The president points out that in the hands of our educators lies the problem of human relationships and the challenge of the atomic bomb. Mr. Truman asserts that the world must look to education in the long run to wipe out ignorance that threatens catastrophe. Said Mr. Truman, it is up to education to bring about that deeper international understanding which is so vital to world peace. And the chief executive maintained that our one defense against the scourge of the atomic bomb rests in mastering human relationships. In his own words, defense against the atomic bomb lies in our mastering human relationships all over the world. And the president adds, it's the defense of tolerance and understanding, of intelligence and thoughtfulness. Through the week, the scarlet name of Pearl Harbor has been brought up time and again. Evidence on the happenings that led to the disaster have been discussed at length. But at the moment, it looks very much like the Pearl Harbor Committee is so sharply divided on its prospective findings that it may have no report on its inquiry before the deadline. That deadline was fixed by Congress as June 1st. Seth Richardson, committee counsel, has laid before the 10 senators and representatives a lengthy summary of all evidence on both sides of the controversial issue. However, this report has provoked varied interpretations by the members. And Senator Ferguson of Michigan says he doesn't see how the group can get together on any recommendations within the next 3 weeks. Well, the former American president has come home. Herbert Hoover returned to Washington after a 35,000-mile trip around the world to study famine conditions. He was met today at the airport by Secretary of Agriculture Anderson and Assistant Secretary of State Clayton. Hoover will confer with President Truman at noon tomorrow. Right after that, Hoover will hold a news conference, but up to that time, the former Republican chief executive refuses to comment on his trip. Along with Hoover, Herbert Morrison, Lord President of the British Council, also arrived for conferences with President Truman. Morrison will remain in the United States for about 1 week, and then he's going to go to Canada to meet with Canadian officials. This past week has seen two red-letter days in the annals of horse racing. Assault followed in the footsteps of his daddy, Bold Venture, to comp the classic Kentucky Derby. And then this very same horse galloped home ahead of the field in the historic Preakness, the richest stake of all. Only the Belmont Stakes remains ahead of Assault, for the proud thoroughbred makes it a grand slam among the major turf classics. And this was the week when the two most famous outfielders in the major leagues, Ted Williams and Jolton Joe DiMaggio, came up to plate with the same problem. The bases were loaded. Joe DiMaggio hit a home run, and Ted Williams struck out. But Williams' team, the Red Sox, went on to win the game. One of the craziest stories of all came out this week, a story just chock full of monkey business. It seems that about 75 monkeys broke out of their pet shop in Manhattan and started out making their own way in the world. Most of them seemed to prefer the grocery business or the liquor shops. They were everywhere, with the police frantically trying to capture them alive. Finally, all but 15 were rounded up, and those are still at large. No one knows why the monks took it on the lam. Some say they just went stir crazy. In any event, it was more fun than a barrel of people. Orson Welles will be back again next Sunday with his regular commentary. You've heard a special news program reported by George Hayes. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.